And thus, if there are other entities or other dimensions or other things happening, it is possible for these things to come into our experience.
Welcome back to another week of Mind Matters, everyone. I'm Harrison Cayley, joined by Adam Daniels and Luke Koch. Today, we have joining us again. Last time we had him on was probably, well, it seems like probably a couple years ago now, John H. Buchanan. Last time we had him on, we talked about Whitehead, and he had co-edited a book on consciousness and philosophy and fun things like that. And in the meantime, he has published the book he was working on, Processing Reality, Finding Meaning in Death, Psychedelics, and Sobriety. This one just came out earlier this year. Is that correct, John?
Last fall.
Oh, last fall. So it's been, so it's been about a year that it's been out. And I just finished it. And Adam's been reading it, and we're all fans of Whitehead. And
you've got some very interesting stories.
Yes. John has some very interesting stories, which we'll get into. So first, welcome to the show again, John.
Thank you. It's great to be back with you guys.
So the book is, let me try to describe the book. So it's not a very long book. It's about 250 pages, plus some extra material. And it's very much in the Whiteheadian tradition. So it's got a lot of process philosophy in there, but it is not like, it's only 250 pages, but it's still got a lot in it. Like there's no way that we can cover like a fraction of the ideas that John has in this book, in this conversation. So that's why I'm just going to go ahead and recommend that everyone read it and just treat the conversation we have as like a little taste, a little tidbit of what's in there. And the book is also not just a, you know, treatise on process philosophy or anything like that. It's a very personal book. This is John's, John's story, and then how that gets tied all together, for us and for him with philosophy and transpersonal psychology. So John, maybe you could describe it in your own words. Like, what is this book? How did it come to be? And how did you kind of decide how to put it all together?
That's a pretty good description. Thank you. In a way, it's my attempt to popularize my dissertation, so that was about 30 years ago. So it took a while. You know, the first time I took my dissertation was basically on the same material on process thought and transpersonal psychology, but it was very long and even more technical. And I tried to rearrange it and put it into sort of a different order and better. And then I sent it off to David Ray Griffin. And he said, why don't you start from scratch? So my working title has been From Scratch since then. And I guess about 10 or 15 years ago, I've been writing papers and doing other things. Then I'd get back to it. And I thought, you know, since Whitehead focused, you know, the starting point is our own experience. You know, he's like Descartes in that way, although a twist on that. So I thought, well, you know, maybe if I talk about my own experiences and that led to me investigating some of these ideas of existential and epistemological and metaphysical and cosmological nature. Maybe if I talk about my own experience, how I got into those ideas, it would help people. It would make it more interesting and also see how maybe other people had similar interests. It would make it more accessible that way. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of that worked, and some of it I still have left over from my dissertation that I never successfully made as accessible as I would have liked. But Whitehead, you know, I also wanted to go fairly deeply into Whitehead's ideas for the people who are already familiar with Whitehead, so there'd be something new. And I think there's some very important ways that Whitehead explicates not an ordinary experience and psychedelic states that I think is very promising in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I constructed the book around five pivotal experiences in my life, and my father's death at an early age, and getting into drugs and alcohol, and then psychedelics and a powerful psychedelic experience, and then finally running into trouble with my love with the drugs and psychedelics, and finally having to choose between those and living, basically. So I've been sober for a long time, and so every year I think about doing psychedelics, but then I say, not yet, not yet. I've got some things I need to do first before I take that chance.
No, that's good. Well, I think you did a good job of kind of popularizing the ideas, because you can take a book like Process and Reality, which is really technical and generalized, and it's not written for a general audience, right? You're not going to pass this on just to a random person on the street and blow their mind with it necessarily.
John Cobb, who's one of the great Whitehead interpreters, especially theologically, I heard him say once that he wouldn't even recommend that a professional philosopher try to read Process and Reality without some help from someone who's familiar with it already.
It doesn't help that Whitehead starts it all with this like endless list of definitions where it's like, oh my God, like.
I think he later on said he was kind of embarrassed by his hubris and thinking that he could lay it out like a mathematical formula to start with. But that was his training. He was a mathematician, Mm-hmm. that is an overwhelming beginning. I just skip right over that part.
So one approach could be to present the technical, philosophical arguments and details, and then say, oh, and here's some application for it. But what you've done is kind of turned that process around and started with the phenomena, started with the experience, like you said, which is the process that kind of led Whitehead to develop his philosophy. Is he was starting with experiences and then laying out all of his all his speculative philosophy about those experiences. But so what you've kind of given an inside look at that process itself. So you start with the experience, you lay out all these, crazy psychedelic experiences that you had, and then say, okay, well, that's the experience. And now look at how this can fit into this philosophical framework. And isn't that nice? Doesn't it all fit together very nicely? Right. So I think it's a really good approach. It's a really good approach for such difficult material. It's not just like a simplification, like, oh, here, let me try to rewrite Whitehead in terms that are, simpler for, people who aren't familiar with it. Although there is that, but I'd say it's just much, a much more kind of integrated way of getting across the ideas. So yeah, good job.
Thank you. I was appreciative to hear that you'd finished it, because I've run into quite a few people who say, yeah, I've been reading your book. I'm not done yet, but I've been reading it. Kudos to you.
I was guilty of that, because I read the first, the first eight chapters. It's 12 chapters. So yeah, I'd read the first eight chapters, and then for whatever reason, just earlier this year, I just had something else come up. So I just put the book down and then didn't pick it up for another few months, and then just tore through the last few chapters. Not to say that's not a diss of the book or anything like that. I literally just put it down with the plan to get back to it. And as soon as I picked it back up, it came right back. But
that's how almost all my reading goes.
Yeah. Yeah. I do that a lot. But maybe we can, let's get into some of those experiences, because before we started recording, Adam made a little joke that that you've had quite some interesting experiences, right? We were talking about it, and maybe we can start with something from near the end of the book as a way into your past, because you mentioned right now that in this earlier part of your life you were doing a lot of drugs and alcohol. And there's a funny, well, it's probably funny in retrospect, and it's funny reading it, story about, I think it was when you went to rehab that final time, and was it the doctor, for the doctor that you had to list all of the drugs that used at various times? Am I getting that wrong? What was
It wasn't my last rehab. It was actually the first real treatment center. Yes.
Okay, the first one. So, well, just tell that little story about what the how that went.
Well, at that point, I realized, since I'd been basically going to DTs before I got there, that I was in a lot of trouble with alcohol. But, you know, I'd done quite a few drugs, but I really didn't feel like I was addicted to those. You know, I thought alcohol was the problem. So the counselor down in Sioux City, Iowa, where I'd flown down to, said, well, why don't you make a list of all the drugs you've used? You know, so I was kind of proud of it. So I was, you know, making this long list of things I'd taken. And he looked at it and said, I don't even know what some of these are, you know? And it was my first real confrontation with the fact that the reason I wasn't physically addicted to those particular drugs was because I was doing other things and I could substitute, and I always had the alcohol in the background. So it was my beginning to realize that I had a problem with those substances too. But nowadays my list would look pretty short, probably. You know, there's so many designer drugs, and, you know, ketamine wasn't even around, or fortunately crack. But in those days, apparently it was fairly impressive. impressive.
Yeah, that kind of impressive. Well, I think that that goes into kind of the duality of drug use, and especially like psychedelics that you get into in the book, is because for a lot of people like yourself, it was this kind of mind-opening and mind-blowing experience. But on the other hand, it can come with a lot of, less positive things, like the whole addiction spiral maybe you could talk about that. What do you see as kind of the pitfalls of drug use and psychedelics? And then what have you personally seen to be the possible, like, you know, positives in your life? How would you categorize that, or, you know, tease that out?
Well, in the positives, it completely shifted my understanding of the world and what was possible, and really brought me out of what I think was a latent depression from my father's sudden death. Both sort of physically and psychologically opened me up in a way. You know, it didn't solve those problems, but it gave me a sense that there were some possibilities I hadn't even thought of entertaining, or except when reading, you know, comic books or science fiction. So it was it was very exciting to feel that the world that was much deeper and wider than I'd thought. So there are a lot of, you know, as I probably quote Kant in there, it woke me from my dogmatic. Oops, hold on one second. I must have hit something here.
I think that's a good quote from Kant. You know, from the dogmatic oops.
Sorry about that. Alan Parsons Project Eye in the Sky came on my headphones. I have to be careful what I'm touching. Yes, woke me from my dogmatic slumber. Yes. The downside, if you happen to be have an addictive personality, then, you know, any drug you're taking is going to probably get out of control in some way. Back in the late 80s, when I was studying with Stan Grof, he said he was surprised. He really thought that that psychedelics were not a drug that people could abuse or get addicted to, because, you know, they're so powerful. You take it and you don't want to, I think I'll take some more, right? You know, it's sort of self-limiting thought, but, you know, recently he'd encountered some people that were running into trouble with psychedelics. And I don't know what he would have thought about microdosing. People drink every day and it's not a problem, but other people, when they're drinking every day, it is. Have you heard of the Semantrix? I've met these two women over in Exeter, England at a conference we put on there, and they're doing this podcast where they're looking at psychedelics and language and multiple perspectives. And they had a woman on from England who had been studying the problems arising from ketamine use. And apparently Brighton is quite rampant. And they have some joke about everyone sitting on pillows down there because it hit, one of its side effects is a prolapsed anus. So it's so there's, you know, apparently almost anything can get you into trouble if you take too much of it, you know. And of course, psychedelics in themselves, if not used in a proper set and setting, are such a powerful psychoactive substance that, you know, it can cause people can get into real psychological trouble with them very easily. You know, a lot of people, you know, I tell about how excited I am. And they go, well, you know, I stopped using it because I had a bad trip. And, you know, that's pretty frequent. I hear that. So they need to be treated with great respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you mentioned Stan Grof. And you are a holotropic breathwork like practitioner, and so that's one of the features I like about the book is that I think probably some people might have the impression that psychedelics are the only way to like enter a non-ordinary state of consciousness, and like my personal perspective, like I don't do any psychedelics. I've never actually done any psychedelics, but I guess my personality has been more open to some of the realizations, I guess, that people get from psychedelics. And so, I mean, I would like read Carlos Castaneda or something like that back as a teenager and be like, oh wow, you know, I totally believe this, you know, even though, you know, it was probably a lot of fiction in there, but the, you know, the whole, like, I can see this actually happening. So, but there are natural, I mean, without ingesting like a foreign substance, there are like techniques and ways of kind of approaching similar states of consciousness. And I think that for a lot of people, like that's probably, a more healthy way into it. You know, to avoid the possible psychological, you know, the bad trips and the possible psychotic breaks or the possible addiction spirals. Like you said, unless psychedelics are, you know, taken or administered in a controlled setting where people know what's going on and are like supervised to, you know, to make a, you know, as safe an experience as possible. You know, maybe for the people that, you know, that are potentially at risk of having like a very negative experience, maybe start out with something like, what did you discover like in the period of sobriety and researching and experimenting with, you know, different things to achieve states?
Well, I think if you're going to actually start with a more mild drug, from what I wasn't privy to it in my day, but from what I hear, MDMA or ecstasy is a drug that sort of opens the heart, and although it's a bit of an, you know, it's an amphetamine also, so you need to be a little bit careful, but it's a considerably gentler introduction into a psychedelic state. But, you know, I mean, more getting back, I think, to the essence of your question, you know, I studied with Stan Grof. I did a 3-year training group with him in holotropic breath work, and he was on my dissertation committee. And I read his book back at New College. I don't think I mentioned it in my, maybe I do mention it in my book. He mentions that the high dose psychedelic sessions could help with alcoholism, which I already recognized I had a problem. So I got 6 sets of blotter. I was going to take them all, and I lost 4 of them, you know, which is just, so I never fully tried the experiment, but I was reading his book and I found his work so very helpful for in maybe 2 primary ways. One, it describes this broad range of experience that people have in non-ordinary states and psychedelic states. And thus it gives kind of like, oh, wow, I had that experience, but so have hundreds of other people. And it's sort of made me feel like this is more normal than I thought it was. And perhaps it's also a real part of, you know, some part of reality that I should be taking more serious account of, and not just dismissing as hallucination or that was my trip, you know. But the other part, he goes into quite a bit of discussion, as do other people, but he does it in a very nice way of that people have been exploring non-ordinary states since as far back as we can go. I mean, even in the shaman's graves from 30,000 years ago, they find psychedelic plants, you know, buried with the shamans. But people use drumming, they use dancing, there's, you know, all the forms of meditation, there's sensory deprivation. We have a place here to do sensory deprivation tanks here in Appleton, Wisconsin. There's hypnosis. I mean, there's so many alternative ways of going into non-orders. You know, they're really developing a lot of like light and sound technology now. Mm-hmm. I haven't found anything. I've tried a few and they don't seem particularly effective for me, but I'm kind of a hard case of moving me into altered states, which is why I think I gravitated to stronger substances to open me up. Mm-hmm. But yes, that, you know, there's all these ways. I mean, you know, as kids, there we are, you know, on merry-go-rounds and spinning around and, you know, altering our states, I think it's a natural thing for people to want to explore these spaces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We can go a bit in the direction of like, what is the relation between like altered states and let's say our regular reality? Because people often talk about, you know, like that they're having like a kind of a mystical experience or an epiphany in these altered states, and they bring something back, right? A new insight about reality. But obviously we cannot live in altered states, you know, constantly. It seems to be more like something that brings a new awareness to this reality. So I wanted to ask, because you talk in your book a lot about the metaphysics of it all and how it changed your view of reality. So what is your take? How do these two worlds, if we want, fit together, or put another way, in our ordinary experience? What is this? What does this tell us? You know, about even like our ordinary sensation, feeling, thought, that these realities seem to be possible.
That's a big question. Yeah. Have you read any of Stanislav? Have you read any of Stanislav Grof's books?
No.
One of the differentiations he likes is to hylotropic versus holotropic. So hylotropic is the everyday experience, and the holotropic is he sees as these healing and opening up non-ordinary states. So moving towards the whole. I'm not sure how far you can go with that differentiation, except I was at a conference once, and a person in the audience said, "So Stan, when you look at people, what do you see, like flaming torches, or, you know, how do you see the world?" He goes, "Well, you know, when I'm not taking a psychedelic, I see it like everybody else does, you know." So I think people had thought that, you know, if you go into altered states far enough, the way you perceive the world would be completely transformed. You know, I think perhaps, I mean, I think there is some of a change in that. Maybe, you know, for people it becomes maybe more fluid, and especially the way your internal way of processing the world, you know, maybe take things a little easier. You drop away some of the tension and the ego gripping on and needing to be right and all these things. So I think there's things that are brought back from non-ordinary states into our everyday state. But I think it's more, you know, this is why I found Whitehead so fascinating, because the question is, you know, you have a mystery, especially with things like ayahuasca, where people encounter these entities, you know, like plant entities that speak to them and tell them, you know, some mission they should be on, or they encounter these, animal gods. Or, are those real? You know, what would real mean in this case? And I think for even with Whitehead, that becomes hard to parse out. And I've never had those experiences. So I think that's some of the ultimately challenging parts. But I think, you know, some of, you know, I mentioned my, one of my experiences where I in my psychedelic state, I saw that somehow a sine wave was the essence of the universe, you know, which at the time it's felt very, you know, things in psychedelic states tend to have a feeling like this is the most important thing you've ever thought in your life, you know, and I wrote it all down and lost it. But, you know, so like many years later, I was thinking about it and thought, well, that's exactly, in a way, what, you know, what Whitehead is talking about, these momentary flux of occasions. And so I think in these states, you can really tap into, say, metaphysical insights that have a real, have some real philosophical validity. And people seem to have these experiences at times of like witnessing the Big Bang and going through the history of the universe. Now, I'm just reading a book called the The Electric Universe, which I hadn't, a friend's father sent me this, some other books on this. And it's the idea that, you know, plasma, electromagnetic plasma makes up 99% of the universe. And that's really what's making things work versus gravity. And that, you know, there wasn't a Big Bang. We're in a, you know, infinitely extending time-wise universe. So I started thinking, well, what about these people that have had experiences of the Big Bang? What does that tell us? You know, where they were, you know, projecting what, you know, the theories they had in their mind and having a vivid experience of what they've read, but, you know, maybe it isn't accessing the past. So I guess I'm not going to be able to help you out much, really. I think Whitehead's helpful for sorting out a lot of things, and there's still, you know, so many questions, you know, that's left unanswered, you know, especially around the kinds of entity, you know, some people experience aliens, you know, they have alien encounters, as it were. And, you know, people in normal states of consciousness have these alien encounters. And, you know, what do we make of these? There's a man in our holotropic breathwork training group who is regularly visited by this being from some other planet and who is, you know, telling him all these things. And I said, well, you know, so I was trying to sort out, you know, is this real or not? And, you know, and Stan has a thing where he talks about psychoid states where it's, so it's not, you know, it's real, but it's not real. It's psychological, you know. And I said, yeah, but that doesn't really answer it. And do you know Rick Doblin? He started MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which has been behind a lot of the has gotten funding and pushed through the psychedelic research. Anyway, he was at college with me, and then he was in this training group. And so he said, well, if you got on a spaceship and flew to the planet this being says they're from, would they know that? Would they know that guy? You know, and so, yeah, that's, I tend to also have kind of literal mind. You know, I want something solid also, not just, oh, it's real, but it's not real. That doesn't help me out a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you were able to bring that forward into, you know, the like 2/3 of the book that I've read thus far, where, you know, where you're using Whitehead's ideas to explain not necessarily the context nor the content of the experiences, but rather the experience itself.
The shape of
the shape of it, how it kind of intrudes into your awareness and where that could all be coming from, either from like some top down or bottom up thing. Just maybe not necessarily like giving it all 100% like clarity, but rather like, I think getting us closer to where these different experiences are actually existent, or how they actually manifest in, you know, as an experience. And it's all kind of like really hard to say, but like,
where do they fit in?
Yeah.
In what we consider to be, you know, the fabric of our everyday experience, because for many, it's like, this is the way the world is. This is the way normal experience is. And then there's this anomalous thing that enters that doesn't seem like the ordinary experience, right? It's non-ordinary. And it could be like you described the different kind of, I think it was three main types of like psychedelic, like non-ordinary perception. Like one being this vividness, right? Where seeing something that you would ordinarily look at and have a certain reaction to, it's all of a sudden the same thing, but more vivid, and there's more life to it. Carry on.
Yeah. So I was just wanting to say that, you know, like I appreciated what you were trying to do, because it was questions that I myself have had. Like I tried acid once, didn't do anything for me at all. But just with my, you know, experience with like alcohol and, you know, spinning around on the merry-go-round, like all these kinds of things, it's like they left an impression in my mind, because when I was, you know, tried to understand where it all fit in, it's like not really having any kind of context to it. And your ability to take the psychedelic experiences as well as trans psychology, or the psychology of non-ordinary states, and give them the philosophical underpinning and framework to treat them as real, which is like, I think the biggest thing for me was just the fact that it's like not just you know, the way that you would hear, say, an atheistic materialist say or dismiss all sorts of psychedelic experiences merely being like functions of brain chemistry. Like it's like that there's no real reality to the experience itself, regardless of the fact that this is an experience that you're having. So there is some reality to it. It's just a matter of like being able to understand it. So I think that it was really fascinating to read how Whitehead can fit in or provide support for those non-ordinary states. And I don't know if you got into this, but maybe we could go there and say, like how did Whitehead come into this for you? Like, where did this exposure come from that led you to think that, you know, this sine wave of reality could be related to Whitehead, and that it would be helpful in some way? Like, where did that come in?
Let me answer that last, but first let me say thank you for bringing all of it up, because that's Whitehead's idea of what experience is and how human perception works is really key. You know, I'm not saying any of these experiences are necessarily metaphysical, or how should I say it, are objectively real, so to speak. But the Whitehead's approach allows the possibility that we are in contact with things outside of ourselves, which really, I mean, since you, we don't know if we're really touching in contact with anything. You know, we're what does Santayana say? The solipsism of the present moment. You know, that's all we've really got with a perception theory that science wields around. You know, that we're and you know, we don't know anything's real. We can't, there's no cause. In any case, Whitehead offers an alternative to all of this, where the past events are flowing directly into new events, like they do in the quantum world, or at our level, at, you know, the way memories enter into our experience. You know, they just suddenly kind of flow in, or the way our bodily sensations somehow, you can feel, you know, you feel your stomach's upset, but it's also in your experience. You know, it's in your experience, sort of in your head, and vision. You know, you can sort of feel in your eyes, it's flowing in. You know, so Whitehead expands that the world, the universe broadly and subtly is flowing into all of into every moment of experience. And thus, if there are other entities or other dimensions or other things happening, it is possible for these things to come into our experience, you know, including if there's a God, then, you know, God could enter into our experience. Actually, Whitehead probably would say that that is the case. For him, though, it was a sort of a philosophical matter that he felt the universe has this deep order to it. And if there's this kind of deep order and progressive complexity, there needs to be something providing the framework for that order. So he thought there had to be something pushing us, you know, towards greater order and complexity. And that something would be something like what we traditionally think of as God. I got into Whitehead. I'd gone to New College and studied psychology and philosophy and whatever looked interesting. And then I went up to the University of Wisconsin of Green Bay and took more traditional psychology and actually got into some real philosophy courses, you know, Kant. And I thought phenomenology was very exciting because it was about experience and, you know, direct sort of human science. And then went to West Georgia College, which had a humanistic psychology program and continued in all these things. But I felt like there was something, there wasn't a large enough context or framework, some way to connect our neuroscience, the neurological functioning with our everyday perceptions and also, you know, mystical, not ordinary states, you know, something that could connect all of those together. And then when I started at Emory, after the first term at Emory University, working on this interdisciplinary PhD program that they had that was terrific, my advisor said, Will Beardsley is leaving at the end of the semester. Maybe you should study Whitehead with, do directed study in Whitehead. And I did something on process philosophy and process theology. And that was all I did that term. And after about 6 or 8 weeks, I finally got an idea of what Whitehead was getting at. I thought, now this is what I've been looking for. And I haven't found anything better yet.
Was there something that particularly fascinated you? Like when you stumbled upon Whitehead, like for the first time, was there, I don't know, like for me, what I really find fascinating is this, like that he kind of gets you out of this dualistic modernist thought world, right? So it forces you to see the unity and to think it all together kind of thing. But was there something that you were like, oh my God, that's just brilliant?
Well, I think the thing that took me the longest to get my mind around was, you know, the actual occasions, also, you know, these moments of experience aren't just the brain, you know, there's a human level, moments, occasions of bursts of feeling that are interacting with the neural activity. So this gives a whole mind, you know, it opens up a key to the, you know, the insoluble mind, body problem, that there's this rapid interaction, the flow of feeling back and forth. So there's downward causation. And it just gave a whole, you know, once you have that, then you can, and if, you know, the neural cells are metaphysically the same as our own moments of experience. And if the whole world is, you know, essentially of these vibrating, feeling, energetic things, it's really quite a vivid, exciting picture of the universe. And I love the idea of the one, his, you know, ultimate metaphysical principle of the many become one and are increased by one. Because, you know, the perennial problem of the many and the how are there many and how is there the one? And in a lot of the approaches, you end up with some kind of, you know, perennial philosophy where we're really all one. There's only one, but somehow we're parts of that one. And William James used to go nuts over all that. His last book, he has a several chapters against Hegel and against the absolute of, you know, if the absolute is everything, you know, then our experience is value, you know, then we're nothing. And Whitehead's approach of that, same as with the brain. Our moments of experience could be interaction with God's experience. So our experience is real, and then it's felt by God. Then we feel God's experience. So it sort of overcomes some of the tendencies in spirituality and the transpersonal. Say, well, so this is an illusion. You know, this isn't real because only God is real. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. All I really know is this. You know, and some wild experiences. So that isn't very satisfying for me either, and makes me feel like I'm really unenlightened. You know, I didn't realize that God is everything. You know, I mean, anyway, those are some of the things that excited me.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you get into some of the kind of direct applications of process philosophy to different, like, non-ordinary states? Like, so how did you put those two together to make sense of, your own experiences and just the, like the entire literature on, you know, on these types of things?
I don't know.
where to start? Well, how about we start with that example that that I gave about the increased vividness. So an experience where it's like all of a sudden what was there, that same object, let's say, is now seems to be sending you like 1,000 times the information or the vibrancy that it was before. So how would you place that within a process philosophy framework?
I did a lot of studying of depth psychology, so I tend to think in that framework. Mm-hmm. So when I read Whitehead, and he has this notion of there's what he calls the concrescence, are these moments of experience or events, of experiential events, where the past flows in. And first of all, is a vague feeling, a grasping of these past events. So you'd have, you know, the chair there, but you'd be feeling more generally the molecular and atomic occasions have, you know, they're vibrating in some color frequency pattern. And that's sort of flowing in. And normally what our experience does is condense and what he calls transmute. So it takes all these individual feelings and pulls them together into something that we can comprehend more easily. So, you know, we see I'm looking at a white chair rather than all of this vibrating, color and energy, because it's more practical to see it, you know, especially to see like a bear coming at you than all this, you know, vibrating brown color and energy, you know, for survival.
Whoa, oh, it's so beautiful.
Far out.
Yeah. You know, bears seem to be very popular now. There's all these bear stories on the internet. So I'm thinking about it. And so, you know, we've developed a way of what he calls perception in the mode of presentational immediacy. You know, so we see things that are practical and getting our way around in the world. And it's, you know, very helpful. But it also screens out, you know, the much wider things that's entering in. And I think that non-ordinary states open up the channels, as it were. And, you know, Huxley talks about that, and Bergson talked about that. So opening up, and, you know, I picture, you know, you've got kind of this triangle and stuff's flowing in. And there's, you know, you develop these habitual patterns of how these things are put together. And, you know, and some of them are repressed, you know, some of them are based on, you know, I had a bad experience with a bear, so I'm not going to feel any, you know, if I see a bear and feel, I'm not going to feel that. So you end up not feeling a lot from, you know, your youth experiences. So there's a combination. There's this natural way of seeing the world in a way that's practical. And then it's overlaid by all the things that we have shut down, all the, you know, so, you know, that's why, I think that's why recovering sort of the feeling in the body and feelings and memory are so important, because it opens up these channels and you can perceive other things more fully and deeply and connect to them. You know, I think one thing, you know, intuition, you know, people think, well, intuition is, you know, you're reading somebody's face or you remember, you know, with Whitehead's ideas, you are directly feeling another person's experience. So intuition is a direct experience, not a derived experience, as it were. And, you know, Rupert Sheldrake talks about, you know, do you know Rupert Sheldrake? His work on, you know, more recently he's done these books on, you know, that how dogs know their owners are coming home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. whether or not it's the same time, whether it's 5 miles away, they know that the owner's coming. Or that people know when, sense when people are looking at them behind them. They get, you know, you get this tingling. And, you know, these are things that would happen in a Whiteheadian universe, along with parapsychology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find it very interesting that he uses this word prehension, right? And in your book, you kind of translate it as feeling, which I thought also was an interesting take, where you talk about feeling. But I think from what you just said, what I like about the word prehension is it kind of has a this ring, at least since I'm a German, so maybe I have a kind of different connotation to that term, but to me it kind of sounds like a sort of a unity between like the intellect and emotions and bodily sensations and feelings and all of that. It's kind of like a wholesome grasp that kind of unifies all of these things, right? So it's not necessarily just emotion or just intellect or just bodily sensations, but it's sort of everything. And that's how you know, grasp these things and maybe even these parapsychological phenomena, right? Am I onto something there? Do you agree?
I like that. I like that a lot. I wish I could claim that I'd come up with a feeling thing, but what Whitehead talks about these as feelings also, and said, you know, describes apprehension as feeling the feelings of others. So you know, Whitehead plays around a lot with words. He was very sophisticated about language. You know, you didn't have to have like language theorists explain to him that, you know, about, you know, he has a, you know, prehension, you know, he took the word prehensile, you know, which is monkeys have prehensile tails. So you're right. They can grab things. So, you know, you're grabbing the past, you're feeling the past. He's just trying to suggest ways of what, you know, of a new thinking about things. And he talks about how if you have a new idea, if you use an old term for that idea, then people don't know you mean something new. But if you invent a completely new term, then people think you're being obscure, you know? So you've got to find, you know, something like prehensive, which is a, you know, is a word, but you know, it's not, people are not so familiar with it that they immediately think they know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember.
But you're right. I mean, that is, the prehensions are bringing everything in to create a whole. And then there's multiple, you know, Whitehead describes multiple levels of prehension within the concrescent process that are leading towards this intensified feeling and narrowed, intensified feeling. Mm. Have you seen Jude Jones' book called Intensity?
No.
I read that recently, and it's really, I mean, it's technical. You'd want to be familiar with Whitehead before taking it on. But if you are, she thinks intensity should be the basic term in Whitehead's way of understanding a system, because, you know, he says that, you know, that God aims at intensity of experience. That's what the universe is about. And when I was thinking about that recently, I thought, well, you know, psychedelics are like the premier intensifier of experience. So in a way, psychedelics could be the new sacrament, you know. I mean, not just reaching God, but just in general, you know, bringing people alive and intensifying their lives.
Or just really hard gym workouts.
Yes. Well, that's another way of altering, you know, people do these. I spent a year trying to run. I was barely doing a mile. Yes. But other people, I guess they go out there and they get high, you know, they have not ordinary experiences running with the.
Well, John, you mentioned the different, like, phases or levels of prehension, because there's a bunch of different stuff going on in different orders according to Whitehead's scheme, and different things are coming in and coming out. And so in the book, you kind of tie in, this kind of goes back to the question I had about tying these things together. You kind of speculate or, you know, or conclude or argue that different non-ordinary states are kind of like putting the flashlight on, or putting the awareness on different aspects of that, or different levels of that prehension, different stages of those prehensions that are kind of ordinarily, like you said, blocked from consciousness. Like we don't see certain things because they're not practical. But when you kind of like remove that presentational immediacy layer, you might kind of, in a sense, revert back to the more primitive prehension that you're getting from the thing in itself, right? So instead of seeing that chair, you might actually start seeing those vibrating fields of intense, you know, energy and feeling. And it's because you're kind of stripping back the layers of selection and simplification of the data that are, you know, coming to you, and getting to a more kind of, you know, explosive and intense experience.
Sees itself or experiences itself.
Well, maybe. Or what do you think?
Yeah,
I think that's exactly right. I appreciate you. After working on this for so long, when I finished the book, I thought, God, I don't want to think about this anymore for a while. So I'm not as on top of it as I should be. But, you know, one of the things I think is very helpful, you know, there's a debate about how much of our perception, or is all of our perception just culturally conditioned, or are we actually, you know, is there some authentic part coming, you know, of reality coming into our experience? And I think Whitehead's notion that, the past, I mean, the past is full. It's really a correspondence theory of truth. You know, what's corresponding is our experience, how well it closely corresponds to the events that in the past that we're feeling. So, you know, when you take away, you know, strip away some of these habitual patterns of understanding and perceiving, more of the authentic feelings from these events, as you say, can come in and we can have a more direct perception. But, you know, it's always our experience it's always coming into our experience. Mm-hmm. And I would think we're always, to some degree or other, you know, coloring it with our past,
right,
with the way we've come to understand things, you know,
that right. Finish your thought. Or?
I was just going to say, for an example, that the Big Trip, chapter 7, where I talk about a very powerful experience, you know, listening to side 2 of Abbey Road, I go through this thing. I'm climbing up this vision of this climbing up this mountain, and you know, these gods are waiting at the top, and it's sort of this kind of a semi religious, mythological vision, and at the same time, I'm going through this, experiencing all the things I did wrong to people, sort of a purgatory thing. All of that I would see as me using symbolism to, somewhat personal symbolism from my life to create, although archetypal also. And so, some combination of these things flowing in. But at the end, when I'm sort of encountering this powerful light behind being obscured, you know, that felt more to me like there was something that was, you know, really, really there that was coming into my experience. It wasn't, it wasn't filtered, you know, it wasn't something from my, you know, because that was the last thing I expected. So I think, you know, you can see that there's also always some cultural conditioning, but Whitehead's ideas allow for us to also, you know, in just our everyday life, you know, the world is real, you know, which is nice to know.
Well, the couple things on that. Where to start? Well, that idea, maybe I'll just start with that last thing that you said. That gets back to what we were talking about at the very beginning of the conversation here, is that kind of real but not real. It's kind of annoying. It's like, well, is it real or is it not real? It's there's this kind of, the way I kind of see it is that there might be something like an experience of something that's totally outside of your habitual habitual experience for your entire life. Well, if you encounter something that is so far out of that that normal mode of experience, well, what's going to happen? So you have no memory on which to to extrapolate or elaborate what's going on. You've only got your existing experiences. And so if this thing is not a physical object right in front of you that you can say, oh, I've never seen that particular shade of fuchsia before or whatever, you know, there's still a frame of reference by how close it is to the other things that you've experienced. If it's something that's from this other realm, this other world, or this, like this non-physical, part of reality, well, what's your conscious mind's reaction going to be? Well, it kind of makes sense to me that it would clothe it in something at least, you know, a step away within your experience that would, that would make sense for it. And you might even, it might even be a conscious decision on an unconscious level, right? Where the, your mind is like, okay, well, how are we going to get this across to ourselves? Well, this is the perfect way to frame it. This is the perfect way to show it, because that's what we, or I, you know, or little, you know, little John or little Harrison down there, that's what will be acceptable to their mind at that time. You know, maybe push it a bit further, but you know, maybe the experience is just would be totally incomprehensible without that clothing that we put on it.
I think that's a big reason that people say experiences are ineffable, you know, because they're just so different that you don't really have any way of your normal frameworks or language is hard to apply. I was thinking of this, one of the end scenes of C.S. Lewis's book, Perelandra. Actually, that's the imagery from when we going up the mountain and, you know, these gods at the top. And the gods from these various planets have gathered to welcome Earth into the society. And first they appear, at one point they appear as these giant wheels kind of combining together. And C.S. Lewis, you know, the protagonist is, you know, completely overwhelmed and discombobulated by this. And they keep changing shape into something that he can, you know, that he can understand and is acceptable to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, C.S. Lewis, have you read the Space Trilogy by C.S. Lewis? Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra?
I've had it on my list. Yeah.
It's, Perelandra in particular is I wrote a short paper on it about, you know, Stanislav Grof has these perinatal matrices where you think when he did psychedelic therapy with people, they often relive their birth. And like Otto Rank and Freud initially, he thought the birth trauma was birth experience was kind of a template for for the unconscious mind, and it has these different phases. There's the intrauterine kind of oceanic bliss, and then there's the no. They thought Sartre was caught in the second phase, which is the no exit phase. You know, the contractions start, but the cervix is closed. So you can't get out, and you can't get suffocated. And then there's going through the hero's journey through the birth canal, and then opening up into this glorious entry into the world. And and Perelandra is like a perfect exemplification. It starts out with this guy in a white coffin. The protagonist is shipped, sent off of Earth, and he lands in the ocean on Venus in this golden, flowing ocean. You know, it's like the sperms coming in to impregnate the ovum, and it unfolds exactly like this perinatal matrices. It's quite remarkable.
I can't remember if I asked you this when we last spoke, John, but are you familiar with James C. Carpenter, his work? He wrote, he's a psychologist and parapsychologist who wrote a book called First Sight.
We talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah, did we?
My notes from back then. That's why the only reason I can remember.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I thought we might because, I was just, along with, I guess just coincidentally, along with reading your book, I was revisiting just a few pages in Carpenter's book for something that I was writing, completely unrelated. And so I was again seeing the overlap, because like Carpenter, to recap for people who haven't listened to our previous conversation here, where we probably said the exact same thing, Carpenter, came to some very, like, he came to a theory of psi, which is basically a theory of consciousness because and experience through basically his theorizing just based on psychological and parapsychological research. And the picture that he came up with was remarkably similar to Whitehead's philosophy, even though while he was developing it, Carpenter wasn't even aware of Whitehead. And then during the process, someone said, I can't remember if someone showed it to him or if he saw someone else using the word prehension. And he's like, oh, that's the perfect word. And so he uses the word in his book, even though he hadn't read, he hadn't read any Whitehead. But there are some very interesting similarities, because he's talking about parapsychology and you're talking about transpersonal psychology and psychedelic experiences. He's talking about, you know, lab experiences and everyday life experiences of telepathy and PK psychokinesis, and basically putting all of that in the same picture, so that just like in this transpersonal world, and it, like you said, if there is God, maybe we can directly experience God. And maybe, like Whitehead might say, God is a constant presence at some level of our experience or apprehension, and we just aren't always aware of it. Like, that's one of those things that kind of get blocked off from our conscious awareness in any given moment, but it's always there under the surface. So that's another non-ordinary state, would be to remove all of the other levels of experience and just feel that presence from the initial aim that's coming towards us, and that push forward, and the source of our own consciousness, our own being. But I probably had a question I was getting to, but just go on.
You reminded me that yes, the his idea of the psi as this baseline unconscious activity that's feeling the world is right. Almost identical to Whitehead's notion of how we're apprehending. I think when we talked about it, I said I'd want to specialize the term psi for other aspects in Whitehead's picture. But yeah, it's really close. And with the I think I go into some slight detail in my book about how, yes, we are, you know, God is entering into our experience, and Stan Grof's ultimate transpersonal experiences are of the demiurge, which is sort of the creative God, the universal mind, you know, which is the mind of the universe, and the metacosmic or supercosmic void, which is kind of this mysterious experience of pure potential, where everything's there, but you know, nothing's happening. And these fit, I think, extremely well with Whitehead's notion of what is. He has just a short chapter at the end of Process and Reality that he kind of throws in, I think, because he couldn't resist, about what God might be like. Mm-hmm. And he's got these two aspects, the consequent nature of God, which is God's ongoing conscious integration and preservation of all that happened, and then the primordial nature, which is this pool of all possibility that we can draw on, but it's also a graded envisionment. So there's certain things that God in this universe would like to see occurring, probably like conscious intense experience. So that's things mm-hmm. are kind of juggled around in a way to kind of foster that kind of thing. And and yeah, so the supercosmic void, when Grof describes it as this pure potential of creativity, but it isn't real, you know. These things are very, very close to what Whitehead was describing. So, you know, I find the two of them, you know, they're both very speculative and very exotic, as it were, but they both seem to come to very similar points, Grof's idea of memory without a material substrate, as he puts it, that people seem to have experiences in an ordinary state of things that couldn't have been accessed, you know, from the brain. And what the whole idea of prehension or psi is exactly that. It's accessing things directly, you know, not only, you know, I have a feeling like the brain plays a, you know, seems like it when I try to remember somebody's name and I'm going through the alphabet to find the right letter to stimulate what it might be. I have a feeling there's neural activity happening. I'm, you know, getting some part of the brain with this little cue thing up. So it's more complex than that. We're just, you know, accessing the past, but I think that's a hugely important element, I think, in memory and in perception in general. What was your question, though?
Oh, I have no idea.
Doesn't Whitehead also say something in the end of in this chapter about God, that, you know, something about like experience that is worth preserving, so that in a sense that might tie in with the intensity idea, right? That actually, like, some of the things they that are really worth preserving, God kind of preserves, right? Something that like that.
I think God preserves everything, which is kind of a debate. Does, you know, does God preserve Hitler's, you know, concentration camps? You know, and Stan Grof has a funny line. I don't know where he got it from. That, you know, about why, you know, why there's evil in the world and why there's, you know, all these things. And I think some Indian guru responded, well, because it thickens the plot. it makes it more complex. You know, then there's people, heroes, and, you know, creates the whole mm-hmm. melodrama, as it were, for God. Yeah. I don't quite
raises the stakes
go along with that. I think the idea from Whitehead is that if you have a universe where the creativity is spread out among the creatures and God, and you're trying to build complex entities that have their own creativity, shit's going to happen, you know.
Well, here, let me read a quote that you have in the book from John Cobb on evil. I think this is a good one. Let me just check if there was something before it. No, okay.
I recommend so if John Cobb's writings a lot. He's able to express these ideas very, very clearly.
So here he is. This is from God and the World. He wrote, "If God is understood as that factor in the universe which makes for novelty, life, intensity of feeling, consciousness, freedom, and in man for genuine concern for others, and which provides that measure of order which supports these, we must recognize that he is also responsible in a significant way for the evil in the world. If there were nothing at all, or total chaos, or if there were only some very simple structure of order, there would be little evil. There would instead be the absence of both good and evil. Earthquakes or tornadoes would be neither good nor evil in a world devoid of life. Only where there are significant values does the possibility of their thwarting, their conflict, and their destruction arise. The possibility of pain is the price paid for consciousness and the capacity for intense feeling. Sin exists as the corruption of the capacity for love. Thus God, by creating good, provides the context within which there is evil." I thought that was a really good paragraph.
Yeah. Charles Hartshorne, who was John Cobb's teacher at Chicago, I wish I was one of those people that could remember important quotations, but I'm not.
No, me neither.
But he says something to a similar effect that, you know, if you're going to have freedom and novelty and choice, then, you know, life is absurd to the extent that these things happen. But, it's not absurd because you wouldn't have all these possibilities. You know, I mean, you wouldn't have evil if they're saying with the good. So he has a very nice refutation, I think, of the existentialist that life is absurd.
And I think, you know, the classical problem of evil, that God is all powerful, all good, and so on. I think I think it was David Stove who said, you know, about that, something along the lines of, like, if your premises just consistently, like, produce nonsense, you know, maybe it's time to reconsider your premises, right? And as far as I understand, in the Whitehadian universe, I mean, God is not all powerful, right? So I mean, if you go about it in this kind of intellectual, logical puzzle kind of way, so solved, you know, that's it, you know. I mean, it still doesn't answer, like, our you know, intuition about, like, how, you know, that just the suffering, you know, that comes from evil and all of that, but at least, you know, that this logical puzzle isn't that important anymore if you have a Whitehadian perspective that, yeah, I mean, God is, you know, not all powerful. It's not this, like, a human on steroids kind of thing, you know, that's sitting in the clouds and can just, you know, like reach down and throw guns, you know, like out of killers' hands or something.
Yes. Yeah, that, thanks for bringing that up. That's David Ray Griffin has several books on theodicy, which I didn't know what that means. I think it's, but it's theory of why is there evil? And he, that's exactly the route he goes, that for him, God is all good. God is all knowing, although God doesn't know the future because there's creativity and the future isn't settled. But yes, God is only, is the most powerful that a God, entity could be, but does not control it, is, you know, operates through persuasion. There's several people, my colleagues, that have a little bit of debate going on whether God is all good also. So they're fighting that out a little bit. But one of the things I like that David says, that a lot of religious people would rather have God be all powerful and responsible for evil than think of God as not all powerful.
Yeah, it's very true. Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of a projection almost, right? That we project these very human ideas about good and evil and what is power and that sort of thing. And onto like a God that we, it's just, as I said, like a human on steroids. But it's all, always struck me a little strange, this idea. I mean, what does all powerful even mean, you know, or all good? It's, I mean, we know that, you know, like 5 years ago, I had different ideas about like what good is, you know, what good and evil is, and it will probably change again and be refined. And how could we even know, you know, what God would think of all good, or even, what all powerful would be? Is it a persuasion thing? Is it like a total control, like micromanagement? All of these things, and I think the some of those classical theological questions that, as you said, is sort of it's sort of a limited understanding, and people are so married to them, right? It's kind of strange.
You reminded me that David Griffin also says that a God that was all powerful and controlling everything wouldn't really be all that powerful, because, you know, you just got puppets. You know, that really isn't, you know, if you're running everything, that isn't much of an exertion of to be trying to persuade other entities who have their own creativity and direct them into, you know, particular channels. You know, that's, you know, a real project, you know, that's a real effort, you know.
And especially if one of the means by which such a God may have to do that is through other beings. Right. It's because kind of one of the ways I've been thinking about omnipotence is to kind of like with Luke, well, maybe we can just kind of redefine it, because if God is in some sense the container of everything, you know, we are all within God and God is within us, in kind of a panentheistic statement, then where did I start there? Oh no, the train of thought got derailed.
Something of power, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah. Okay. So power. Yeah. So if in some sense we are all part of that whole, then you can say, okay, the whole has all power. All power is contained within that whole, like all, because there can't be any power outside of it, because it is all that exists. And so everything within that is an expression of that power. And it is, so it's like the power of any individual, the power of any one that is built out of those many, and is built on top of those, out of and on top of those many, you know, the many plus one, each one gets that power from that all-powerful source. It is an expression of all that power. And in a sense, even like a holograph, you know, or a hologram of that power, it's like all that power is contained in some sense or some portion of it in that one little being. And so technically your power that you are using to, you know, make all your choices is an expression of all that power. Like God does hold all of the power, but you're actually the one that's wielding it in this reality. And so so in a sense, God is almost like the parts that are within God are kind of at war with themselves, and And so if you give a bit of your own freedom to two parts of yourself that then go to war with each other, you know, there are two expressions of your will, but one just isn't listening as hard as the other might be. But I don't know. I haven't fully developed that, but
I think a lot of that's a really close description of what Whitehead means by creativity. You know, his power is this creative. That's it. That's the ultimate metaphysical principle of everything, is creativity. And he does say that God is the aboriginal instance of creativity, but creativity is, creativity is not a thing in itself. It's something that's characterized in every event, but it's every event, that's all the many, that's the integrative activity, is the creativity. So I don't think Whitehead would think of God as giving the creativity to the particular entities, but God's creativity would be flowing into every entity in the initial aim. So, I mean, you could say that and be right. But having studied with David Griffin, who was Sherburn did the corrected and annotated reboot of Process and Reality, which was this enormous project of going through it, because Whitehead never revised his stuff; he just kept writing. And when he changed his mind about something in Process and Reality, he just, hey, you know what? Now I'm thinking of it this way. I didn't bother changing the conceptual reversion at all. So anyway, that's my long way of saying I'm parsing something that doesn't need to be done. So I like what you said. And perhaps this will be the revision for Whitehead that people will like. One thing about him was he didn't think he had the perfect system by any means. Speculative philosophy is the ongoing endeavor to find a framework of ideas, general framework of ideas. And so it's ever changing and ever hopefully progressing into better understanding. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that kind of contributed to that way that I've been trying to think about this is one idea that I like from Bernardo Kastrup. Have you heard of Kastrup? He's a computer scientist or a computer engineer who got, in his late in his career. Well, he's still a pretty young guy, but after his computer career, got into philosophy and got a PhD, and so he's been trying to reinvigorate idealism, a certain type of idealism. And of course, I've got my own problems with that and the way he kind of goes about it. But one of the ideas that I really liked from him that I thought was kind of just really cool, because I'd never heard it expressed this way, was that the way he sees it, there's this, he probably wouldn't put it like this, but this is the way I've kind of translated it, that the reality is, mind, consciousness, that's kind of the basis of everything, right? As an idealist. And that all of the individuals, all of the beings, all of the organisms, you might say that Whitehead would talk about, all of the actual occasions, they're in fact akin to dissociated personalities within that cosmic mind. So it's like, it's not a perfect analogy, because, we ordinarily think of dissociated personalities as a pathology of normal human psychology. So in a sense you could say, oh, well, God has MPD. But that idea that consciousness does seem to have the ability to kind of almost like divide and encapsulate within one being. So even if you, like Stephen Browdy is a philosopher who's looked at dissociation and trying to look at, what it means, how we can conceptualize it or think of it. But within this, within each individual, which can be seen as a type of self, a type of individual, there does seem to be this real fluid quality to consciousness, that under certain conditions that like inner barriers can be formed between aspects of that consciousness within oneself. And that the process of kind of psychological growth and healing in that case would be reintegrating those personalities, so that there's nothing that's so that those very obviously disintegrated and dissociated aspects of personality are reintegrated. Of course, everyone has dissociated and, you know, repressed stuff like you talk about in transpersonal psychology. But at least in this framework, I thought that was a really interesting way. It would make a great science fiction story, I think, if the universe were presented as the, you know, we're all the dissociated multiple personalities of a, you know, of a schizophrenic and MPD cosmic god. I think
it would make a great t-shirt.
But in some sense, there might be a truth to it, that there's this process of division that happens in the primal cosmic stuff. I don't know, but
I don't. My headphones went off. I hope that isn't going to affect anything. I touched them.
No, it sounds good.
I like that. It's very colorful. Although one of the things I push is, it feels wrong to me for everyone to talk about everything as consciousness. You know, I mean, yeah. I think they mean experience, but consciousness is so misleading because, you know, Whitehead's line that, consciousness is the occasional crown of experience. Because, although some people, I think this, that, you know, the books are conscious and everything's, you know, but I like Whitehead's approach very much, that things have some subtle synthetic activity that resembles, you know, resembles our experience, and that there's a similarity, and this helps with the idea of, you know, evolution of consciousness out of matter, because matter in itself has this fundamental sentience, but when it seems like it confuses the matter, we call it consciousness.
That might, you know, just one really quick, I'm not sure if Kastrup actually uses that word. That might have been me. He might just use the word mentality or mind, so it might be, that might be my bad and not Kastrup's, but
okay,
yeah, but
maybe
but
it's his. I can't remember.
Yeah, but I think that's a general danger with that sort of ideas, even with Kastrup, I think, and even more so if you talk about like the great consciousness or whatever, because there's kind of like the implication there that it might all be an illusion, right? Because that invites that kind of thinking, like it's all like what we perceive is kind of like in our consciousness, right? And it's this sort of idea that nothing is really real out there, right? And that sort of thing. I think that's always the kind of danger when you think about it too much in like everything is mind or everything is consciousness, at least, you know, depending on what you mean exactly by that. But I think that's sort of a danger. And I think what I like about Whitehead is that he kind of like forces you to accept like all of that, the world outside, and makes you think in a sort of more holistic kind of way, perhaps a bit like some of the ancient Greeks actually, who also had this kind of thought that the higher world and the material world, they didn't like distinguish that too much. They at least like the before Plato, right, and the some of the pre-Socratics, and it's something maybe that we should recapture a bit, you know, to not have this dividing line between like the higher world and the earthly world, but this sort of embeddedness and interwovenness, right? That, and I think that comes out very powerfully in Whitehead's system, and we can probably debate, you know, is there any system that is actually true, you know, or is just any system just a way of looking at the world, a certain perspective, you know? But even if we say that, I think Whitehead's perspective is just very, very appropriate or very powerful in that it forces you to overcome that sort of thinking of chopping everything up into like higher and lower worlds and that kind of thing.
I find that very helpful for trying to not having the transpersonal realm and then this world, that there's one universe. What does Whitehead say? Something like, you know, there's all our experience and there's the universe we experience, and beyond that we must remain sort of like a Fichtenstein. We must remain mute, because if we can't experience it, we'll never know it. You know, that's whether it's even there or not. But I do think that, yes, having that's one of the great benefits of Whitehead's philosophy is that everything, you know, the endeavor to account for all experience within a speculative scheme. And he has a, you know, the wonderful line, I'm sure I quote, where, you know, we have to take experience sober, experience drunk, experience sleeping, experience awake, or dreaming, experience religious, experience skeptical. He goes on and on. You know, all of that is potential evidence for understanding. And, you know, that's where he's different, I think, from phenomenology. He wants to take the scientific evidence, you know, and incorporate that into the whole scheme. And phenomenology has, you know, tough time with that. You know, it's not going to, I don't think there's any, well, I don't know of any way to do that from that perspective. I may also mention that you and the viewers might enjoy, there's the Cobb Institute out in Claremont, and they have weekly presentations by various process thinkers. And there's a Process in Faith, which has some interesting things on religion and process thought. And once you get into the, if you go to the Center for Process Studies website, you know, they have a whole bunch of resources. Anyone who's interested in investigating this from someone who talks with people who talk about it better than I do.
Say the name of that. So what should we Google if we want to get there?
I think if you start with the Center for Process Studies, okay. And then we should have links to the Cobb Institute and to Process and Faith as part of the Center for Process Studies.
Okay, cool. All right. We'll make sure to we'll try our best to include links in the description below the video when we put this up. But on the subject of kind of moving into academic domains and projects, what are your thoughts on the recent, what's their name? The guys that are, there's a project to publish, you know, Whitehead's lecture notes, and they're going to be issuing like an edition of his letters and new editions of all his books, you know, probably over the next like 20 years to, it'll be the time by the time it'll probably be 20 years, I'm guessing, before everything's out, but they've got a few volumes out. What do you think about that project?
I've been in touch with them a little bit, and I think they're at Gonzaga University, and they're doing a great job. It's fascinating to see these. I think they'll be doing, you know, new editions of all Whitehead's major books, but they're also parsing through these. It's been a huge project because, you know, they thought, you know, Whitehead, Victor Lowe had said, well, you know, when he died, he told his wife to burn all his papers and letters, and she did that. And it turns out that we don't know if he really said that, but she didn't. So there have been these boxes of letters they found in one of his grandsons or grandnephews up in Canada, had this big resource, and they found in various places, they found notes from his classes, students' notes, some of which are very helpful, some are maybe not so much. But it gives a very different perspective on Whitehead as thinking in a classroom. And he's working out his metaphysics in the classroom with students. So it's interesting to see his sort of unfiltered ideational process and content. And I think it's very exciting. I've got a couple of the books. I haven't read them yet, but I've got one of the collections of his books.
No, I read the first one.
I read the book by, is it Joe Pitak, which is a summary of his thoughts. He's one of the editors of the notes, is what he thinks the importance of the notes are so far.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to have to read that because, you know, you've got to be a real fan to like go into students' notes about the, you know, and, you know,
yeah,
I admire the project, but I wasn't able to get into it. Maybe I'll revisit it sometime, but.
I think that. That book isn't very long, so that's definitely readable. I forget what it's called, but you know, if you look up the people that are doing the Whitehead Project, Joe begins with a P, and then look his book up. It's pretty good, pretty interesting.
All right, no, I'll check that one out.
But speaking of like the overall like academic scene, we talked a little bit about that before we started recording, right? And I would be kind of interested. In you know how you see like this whole thing developing. I mean, when I look like in the mainstream philosophy journals, let's say, you know, it's kind of like you still have all these, you know, battles going on with all these different positions and what have you, and physicalism type A and B and all that. And yeah, these days you have a few panpsychists, but even they are often like very defensive and just keep very close to the, you know, materialist package, so to say. And the Whiteheadians were always like more renegades, you know. I mean, David Ray Griffin went after Darwinism and all that, and that sort of thing is like not really common in academic philosophy, at least in the analytic kind of journals. And I was just wondering, you know, if whether you observe the scene a little bit, you're into the scene. Do you feel like there's more interest in Whitehead and his ideas, and maybe also as they relate to parapsychology or like psychedelics and all of that? Is there like are there more people kind of like fed up with the, you know, analytic mainstream or the continental mainstream and go that route? I heard also that in China apparently Whitehead is popular, and so how do you see that all of that developing?
From what, you know, Whitehead was, you know, in the center of things back in the 20s and 30s. You know, he had his own theory of relativity because he felt that Einstein's metaphysical approach was wrong, and was highly respected and, you know, taken very seriously by philosophers. And then, you know, as the analytic and postmodern movements sort of filtered through America, you know, copying Europe, all that kind of only a few universities remained so traditional. And Emory was one of them, where I went. And Claremont Theology School, where John Cobb was and David Griffin, and the Claremont Graduate School was another. And they started the Journal of Process Studies because it was difficult to get articles published, you know, on Whitehead anywhere else. I think there's been a big change maybe over the last 10 or 15 years. Roland Faber came to Claremont from Austria and did a lot for reaching out to Europe, you know, appealed a lot more to some of the European Whiteheadians because he's a European. I don't know. And he's a very, very, very rigorous thinker. And I don't know how much of that was responsible for it, but it looks to me like there's a lot more interest in Europe and developing, I think, more interest in America also. You're right, China. You know, there's two people, Jaha and May. Okay, she was a professor of literature at Beijing Normal University, and he was at a social science research center, and he got interested in Whitehead. So they came to Claremont, he got a PhD in Whitehead, and the two of them have really created a movement in China. There's 20 or 30 centers for process thought at universities, and recently they ran into, you know, I think the some of the powers that be got a little nervous, you know, that there was this, you know, Western movement sort of associated with Christianity, you know, from Claremont. And so they kind of shut you know, this propaganda came out against it. But I think once, you know, they're very, you know, what Whitehead's thought is very amenable to Asian thought. You know, at one point he says that his philosophy is closer to certain strains of Asiatic thought than to Western thought. And so they, you know, the Confucius, or whether Confucius or Taoist or Buddhist, they have a lot of, they like Whitehead's approaches. And so I've gone over there a couple of times, gone to conferences, and, you know, there's always huge audiences in China because, you know, there's so many people there. But there's a lot of, you know, Jihan may put on do things online, you know, the conferences, and, you know, there'll be hundreds of thousands of people that have, you know, signed in, or so there's a movement there. I believe that's real, depending on the government, how that goes. And in the States, I think things are coming around in the States. I think in the philosophy and departments in general, I think have to give up on the analytic, and postmodernism seems to have sort of used up its energy. And yeah, some places are just closing down. Here in Wisconsin, the university like closed down the history department and the philosophy department. Mm-hmm. Not at Madison yet, but these branch universities. And I think in England, the philosophy departments have been crushed by analytic philosophy. Yeah. And so hopefully this will fill that void. Because I think, you know, I think it's got great, great possibilities. And sorry, I can't give you something more concrete versus American.
No, I was just thinking about like a general sense of like, you know, that, and it's good to hear that there's, that you see that there's movement and there's some growth and interest. That's because, as you said, I mean, with this analytical philosophy or analytic philosophy, it's just it's kind of like a dead end. You read these papers and it's like, you know, I mean, it's just, yeah, what gives, you know? And the same with the, you know, postmodernist streaks in continental philosophy. It's like, it's all politicized. And, you know, if I want to read Marx, you know, I read Marx, you know, but I don't, I don't need like a philosophy, like, you know, like course where everything's, you know, and so yeah, something needs to be done, I guess, or change. And I'm glad to hear that there's at least like an uptick or like an interest, let's say.
I think psychedelics may play a role also. Some friends and I organized a conference in Claremont, and, you know, can extraordinary experience help save the world? You know, it was a little ambitious, but they brought in some people that they'd met at a conference over in Europe from a lecturer at Exeter University. And he and one of his students came. And then a couple of years later, we did a conference at Exeter on psychedelics, but also on process philosophy. And people were very interested. And, you know, he's starting a psychedelics program there. And they have, you know, tons of people that want to be doing this. And, you know, he's Whiteheadian and Spinozan. He thinks Whitehead's better, but he loves Spinoza. And so I think... You know, I keep finding, you know, these people keep sort of popping up that I it was the unknown way. I think there just hasn't been a official academic, you know, large scale way to get into the, you know, the Sorbonne or, you know, but I think there've been a lot of people who've been interested in Whitehead. And once a community develops better and starts infiltrating more into universities, it really should take off, I think. John Cobb put on this conference in 2015 in Claremont, where 1,500 people came, and it was like 50 different tracks and all. He's trying to jumpstart things. And David Ray Griffin gave one of the keynote lectures, and he said that he foresaw that the 21st century would be a Whiteheadian century. And it was his ambitious vision. Mm. Assuming we survive the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you guys have any last questions? We've been going about an hour and a half. I think that's probably a good spot to stop. Unless, John, do you have any final thoughts or things that come to mind to close us out with?
Final thoughts. My friend who put on those conferences, he's very big on the Greeks, and he loves to compare the psychedelics and Whitehead to he's trying to get kind of a mystery school, like the Eleusinian mysteries. So, you know, with a philosophy and an experience, and to bring experience back into philosophy. And, that's what got me interested in the first place. I really hadn't thought about, you know, I studied a little psychology in high school, but it was having some experiences that I wanted to understand is what got me excited and intrigued. So I think he's onto something there. And now that's enough.
All right. Well, again, for listeners, or go ahead, Luke.
No, I was just going to say, get his book, everybody. I'm in the not finished yet camp, but it's really great. So
There are many admirable people in that camp with you.
Great. Again, the book is Processing Reality by John Buchanan. We'll have a link in the show description, also to John's website, where he's got some blurbs, some articles, his names of all the things he's written, and some other talks. So if anyone else wants to check out John's other work, we will be providing that. And one final thought or one final thing. When last time we talked, afterwards, you recommended a couple books to me and sent me a copy of Olaf Stapledon's Star Maker, which makes several appearances in this book. And yeah, it was really cool. It was it was one of those books that's kind of really imaginative and gives a really interesting picture of a world that may be.
It's not everyone's cup of tea, but Stapledon.
Yeah, it's not a novel. It's not a sci-fi novel the way you're expecting it to be.
But it's his Whiteheadian Marxist speculative vision of
yes.
the purpose and meaning of the universe and all universes. So it's pretty broad scope. I mentioned in there John Lilly, who may have been the person who did more studies and experience, not ordinary experiences of almost anybody in the universe. On the back of the 50th anniversary edition of Star Maker, his blurb was something like, "Star Maker is the only book I have ever encountered that can take into account every experience, all the my entire range of experiences that I've had." And so he used to be doing ketamine and writing about alien civilizations and things. So he's had a wide range of experience.
All right, great. Well, on that note, thanks again, John. It's been a blast talking to you. And
thank you guys.
We'll have you on again eventually.
I'd love it.
Thanks.
All right,
John.
Take care.
Take care.